I'll use the devil's advocate.
But advocate away.
Yes. Okay. I'll tell you. You should challenge in the rules of an interview, and you're a master in your business. It's not for me to give you a lecture about that, but you should challenge some ideas. For instance, you didn't talk about freedom of speech in Russia. You did not talk about Navalny, about assassinations, about restrictions on opposition in the coming elections.
I didn't talk about the things that every other American media outlet talks about.
Why?
Exclusively.
Yes, this
because
is my
those
question.
Are covered, and because I have spent my life talking to people who run countries in various countries and have concluded the following, that every leader kills people, including my leader. Every leader kills people. Some kill more than others. Leadership requires killing people, sorry. That's why I wouldn't want to be a leader. That press restriction is universal in the United States. I know because I've lived it. I've had a lot of jobs. And I've done this for 34 years, and I know how it works. And there's more censorship in Russia than there is in the United States, but there's a great deal in the United States. And so, at a certain point, it's like people can decide whether they think, what countries they think are better, what systems they think
Sir,
are better. I just want to know what he thinks. That was the whole point.
All right. I just want to clear this up right now. I have never once exercised leadership on the show.
You've threatened a couple times.
Yes, Chairman.
where do you guys think the other producers go?
Yes. Yeah, it's true. Jake is like the third producer. You never hear from the others. So I am Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. I am joined as always by our super producer, Jake Appett, and our very talented graphic designer, J. Andrew World. And today by Deep State Cuba, who is our resident expert on Eastern European people. So we have brought him in to watch Tucker Carlson's interview of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Cuba tends to be a bit vague about his day job, so I'm not sure how much leadership that requires.
I mean, is it leadership if it's Ewoks? It's more of a tamer, shepherd type role.
Fair enough. That was like a pretty incredible statement by Tucker Carlson. I'm just trying to imagine, it comes out at some point through the, through like the hearings of the 121st Hunter Biden committee that Joe Biden personally ordered the assassination of a couple of Americans. And I was imagining Tucker reacted just what do you want? Leadership does require killing people.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen a lot of people talking about how being conservative today means that you hate America and love Russia, apparently, right? Well, maybe not all conservatives, but Tucker is. We're going to get into that though today, I guess.
So this is one of the reasons I actually thought it'd be interesting to do this, right? Because the thing that you just kind of very dryly repeated just now is sort of the lib line on this, right? Since the Tucker Putin interview happened, that this is. I've seen, think like the Blade Runner speech. I've seen tweets you people wouldn't believe that Putin, that Tucker Carlson should be locked up as a traitor because he gave a softball interview to a foreign head of state, which would mean, for example, that as somebody who used to regularly watch The Daily Show, I definitely saw a few of those on there over the years. So we probably don't want to, apply that standard too consistently. But, and it is actually true that I think there is, some legitimate news value in some of the stuff that certainly Putin, expresses interest in, negotiation, talks a lot about the negotiations that happened in Istanbul. There is some stuff there, the parts that I've seen of this already that is, good. But Also, I think that one of the reasons, you know, I mean, okay, yes, I think that there's a certain kind of conservative who has an instinctive affection for, you know, right wing authoritarians who you know might otherwise seem embarrassing, but you know they're kind of okay with being pretty unabashed about it now. But you know, so that's definitely one level of, you know, interest in this. I actually thought it was really funny seeing the guy at the World Government Forum in the cold open said, "Oh, you're the expert on interviewing." It's like, he is? I mean, is that like, should Tucker give seminars on like exactly how to do that, like slack jawed pause, you know, while the interview subject is speaking? Like that seems, I don't know. Is that expertise? I'm not sure. And it was actually funny. You know, there's a great clip that we might've used, except I think what I saw was all in Russian. I just saw a translation of it. Where a Russian journalist is asking Putin about his thoughts about the interview. And he's like, he didn't really ask good questions. He seems like a very simple man. But like,
I remember seeing that. And when Putin's right, he's right.
Yeah, fair enough. Putin makes some good points. You know, we could question his account of, you know, 15th century Poland and like the lessons that he draws from that. But you know, it's not all misses, right? You know, every once in a while there's a hit.
History is complicated, but identifying idiot is basic KGB stuff.
Exactly. Yes. But it is also really interesting because if nothing else, this is a very, very extended dose of Putin saying the stuff that Putin thinks, which I think in lots of different directions doesn't really fit with a lot of people's impressions, perhaps, of what Putin thinks. There are people, you know, like I think there are, you know, conservatives who have sort of like, there's a certain kind of very online conservative who's decided that Putin is like very based. And some of them, I think, might have been surprised by some of the answers where, you know, in the parts where Tucker is kind of assuming that Putin will like say the same lines as his Western counterparts, that he just doesn't. Like, I watched a little bit of the Left Reckoning episode about this. The part they used as a cold open was, you know, Tucker being like, "Oh, do you ever feel like the hand of God is at work in all these events? And there's something supernatural?" Translated to Russian, Putin speaks Russian, translator back, "No, I don't think that." But there's also this sort of very weird thing where both some right-wingers, you know, often, if not never Trumpers, at least sort of more conventional kind of NatSec right-wingers, and also some of the world's most confused internet leftists kind of have convinced themselves in some weird way that like Putin is like almost a communist, or he might as well be, or, you know, something like that. So I actually wrote something hold on. I'm being told that my audio is a bit loud. I'm going to see if I can mess with my settings, but I'll hold it further away. Until then, I actually wrote something for the Daily Beast about this that came out yesterday about Senator Kevin Cramer, who might actually get the award for the most ridiculous thing that I've ever seen a sitting Republican senator say, which is in explaining his vote for the appropriation for the wars in Ukraine and Israel. He described Putin as I quote, "the modern Marx," which, you know, is very odd on many levels, right? Since, you know, I mean, one of the things I say in the article is that it's like, this almost feels like a setup to an absurdist joke. Like, you know, like even try to refute this feels silly. It's like saying, it's like saying that, that, you know, like, it's like asking like, what are the main differences between Justin Trudeau and, you know, Genghis Khan, right? Like, it's like, where do you start? But certainly given that Putin was the handpicked successor of Boris Yeltsin, who's the guy who did more than anybody else to spearhead the rapid transition to capitalism in Russia, collapse of the Soviet Union, given that Putin is the head of a, you know, even if he's not really as willing to pretend to, you know, to have deep spiritual beliefs as his Western counterparts, is the head of a very socially conservative government that, you know, that, that, that gets a certain amount of legitimacy from its alliance with the Russian Orthodox Church, that, you know, that, that Russia today is actually one of the more materially unequal developed capitalist countries. And that, it, you know, if you go back and watch the big speech that Putin gave when the war in Ukraine started, a couple of years ago, he blamed Lenin for like creating Ukrainian nationalism by like letting them have the status, you know, within the Soviet Union. You know, all of that seems like, you know, really odd to me. I don't think anything much follows one way or the other from it about, you know, the geopolitics. You know, I mean, you just kind of have to evaluate that on its own, but like you should at least, you know, start from the premise that, you know, that right-wing nationalist leader of unusually inegalitarian society who talks about how bad Lenin was is probably not actually a closet Marxist.
I feel like you're missing, though, that Marx was number one Russia guy back when Marx was alive. And now Putin is number one Russia guy, right? Like the guy when you say Russia, you think of Putin. And when you said Russia then, you actually, no, Marx wasn't number one Russia guy when Marx was alive. So Marx.
I was waiting to see you explain what you meant because I was willing to give you like a pretty, I was willing to give you like
a long rope to hang yourself with.
No, it's like I trusted that he was going to come up with something good.
Well,
I think the reason I trusted that is that this is the first episode where Jake has been wearing glasses.
Yeah. Exactly.
Smart guy glasses. You can trust.
Yeah.
Them.
Yeah.
We exactly. All got the smart guy glasses.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, I'll listen to you. Sure. What do you have to say?
It didn't even make enough sense for my joke to work. Ironically, getting used to the glasses is making me dumber because like everything's kind of going in, you know, I'm getting used to focusing and stuff.
Let's get this started. You want to, you know, we are not going to watch the whole thing tonight. The interview is very long, but I do want to at least watch and break down a bunch of this. So let's start it up.
The following is an interview with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, shot February 6, 2024 at about 7 p.m. in the building behind us, which is, of course, the Kremlin. The interview, as you will see if you watch it, is primarily about the war in progress, the war in Ukraine, how it started, what's happening, and most pressingly, how it might end. One note before you watch. At the beginning of the interview, we asked the most obvious question, which is, why did you do this? Did you feel a threat, an imminent physical threat? And that's your justification. And the answer we got shocked us. Putin went on for a very long time, probably half an hour, about the history of Russia going back to the 8th century. And honestly, we thought this was a filibustering technique and found it annoying and interrupted him several times. And he responded he was annoyed by the interruption. But we concluded in the end, for what it's worth, that it was not a filibustering technique. There was no time limit on the interview. We ended it after more than 2 hours. Instead, what you're about to see seemed to us sincere, whether you agree with it or not. Vladimir Putin believes that Russia has a historic claim to parts of Western Ukraine. So our opinion would be to view it in that light as a sincere expression of what he thinks. And with that, here it is.
Mr. President, thank you.
On February 22nd, 2022, you addressed your country in a nationwide address when the conflict in Ukraine started. And you said that you were acting because you had come to the conclusion that the United States, through NATO, might initiate a, quote, surprise attack on our country. And to American ears, that sounds paranoid. Tell us why you believe the United States might strike Russia out of the blue. How did you conclude that?
It's not that America, the United States, was going to launch a surprise strike on Russia. I didn't say that. Are we having a talk show or a serious conversation?
Here's the quote. Thank you. It's a formidable serious talk.
Because your basic education is in history, as far as I understand.
Yes.
So if you don't mind, I will take only 30 seconds or 1 minute to give you a short reference to history for giving you a little historical background.
Please.
It's going to be more than 30 seconds.
There's the first Putin
Let's
lie.
Let's look where our relationship with Ukraine started from. Where did Ukraine come from? The Russian state started gathering itself as a centralized statehood. And it is considered to be the year of the establishment of the Russian state in 862, when the townspeople of Novgorod invited a Varangian prince, Rurik, from Scandinavia to reign.
You can already tell this is going to be more than 30
In 1862, Russia celebrated the 1000th anniversary of its statehood.
Is running through 1,000 years, right? 1,
and in Novgorod, there is a memorial dedicated to the 1,000th anniversary of the country. In 882, Rurik's successor, Prince Oleg, who was actually playing the role of regent at Rurik's young son, because Rurik had died by that time, came to Kiev. He ousted two brothers who apparently had once been members of Rurik's squad. So Russia began to develop with two centers of power, Kiev and Novgorod. The next very significant date in the history
of Russia
like
I need
was
to chime in already. As the Slav whisperer.
Yes.
So what he's describing is a retrospective narrative imposed on this period of history so that it culminates, so that it becomes the story of the Russian state. At this point, it would be crazy to talk about a Russian state forming or gathering itself or any kind of territorially bounded entity which could be called the Russian state. At this point, the polity that he's describing is still referred to as the Kievan Rus, right? A principality based around Kiev, not Moscow, which at this point was completely irrelevant from Russian history. And the entire sweep of Eastern Europe, from the Elbe River in central Germany to the limits of the Tatar presence in Kazan in Siberia, was just a patchwork of different small Slavic chiefdoms and principalities, often just a few towns and villages in the middle of this wilderness. This territory, right, Eastern Europe, unlike the heart of Europe or places like Anatolia, had never been part of an advanced empire, never been part of the Roman Empire. This was an area which had very few roads. Primarily, it was wilderness. And the dynasty that he's talking about, the Rurikids, were Vikings. They were sometimes they're referred to as Varangians, but what that is Vikings from Scandinavia who would murder their way through the river networks of Eastern Europe, gathering slaves and whatever was valuable. And they established themselves as some of these petty chieftains. And it wasn't just the Rurikids, but he had cousins and rivals. So you had a bunch of Slavic chieftains, a bunch of Viking states. And the language hadn't been written yet, hadn't been codified. So you had a little like Italian. You had this giant sweep of territory where the language would shift gradually from town to town. So you started out in what's now Eastern Germany with Poles and Sorbs and Wends and Pomeranians that could, not the dogs, that could talk to one another. And then as you got to Eastern Poland, at that time, right, Poland was also entirely notional. You had the bleeding from Western Slavic dialects into Eastern Slavic dialects, but they could still understand each other. So there was nothing fated about this territory becoming Russia. The people did not think of themselves as Russians. The word Russian was only coined much later, derived from the Kievan Rus, the name that the Varangian lords took for their polity. And so he makes it seem like this is a game of Europa Universalis or Crusader Kings or something, where you start out as Russia and you know exactly what you're doing. But there were other centers of power, Novgorod being one, and Kiev being another, non-Moscow centered, that had different relations with their neighbors and a different way of life, a different material base for their state, and different cultural manifestations of that. He makes it seem like there's this magnetic force, that there's a spirit of history that is compelling these kindred peoples to come together into a single state and then become an actor of history. And across Eastern Europe, nationalism is probably the most dominant framework for understanding mm-hmm. history and politics. And it often takes the form of this trans-historical narrative about where we came from and how we became who we are and how that's fate and how that's the most important thing to preserve. But this whole notion that the Russian state was beginning to emerge from the cocoon, right, and start to metamorphosize into what would become the Russian Federation right now, that's entirely ahistorical. And it loses sight of the fact that at this point, right, the territories in Ukraine could have just as easily gotten along, gotten communicated with, and merged with a Western Slavic polity. Maybe Poland, maybe Great Moravia, maybe Bohemia, right? But he makes it seem as though this is just a natural effervescence and that they were all really into it.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking originally, as you started to say all of that, that it's like a little bit like if you were to, you know, crafting a narrative about the natural boundaries of the United States, you started talking about the Jamestown colony, except that it's actually much more ridiculous than that, since the, you know, with the James,
no, you know, start with Montreal.
Right. And like, also that's like, you know, that's so much more recent, you know, English was well established as a language, et cetera. But yeah, like, I mean, I think there's a general problem here, right? Like, it's not just Eastern Europe, like anybody anywhere using nationalism as their sort of primary prism for understanding history is going to run into this problem that it's this incredibly recent phenomenon everywhere, right? I mean, this is basically something that's, you know, existed in the last, you know, for not that many centuries, you know, in the greater, you know, the greater scheme of things. And, you know, and so you're always doing some sort of like weird retroactive narrative to try to, you know, like that's that nobody ever applies consistently. Right. You know, as people, you know, people talk about, you know, like people who are ardent Zionists talk a lot about ancient Israel in ways that they sort of, I think, would rightly find absurd if you were trying to talk about the Roman Empire. To, you know, to talk about modern Italy, you know, et cetera, like that this is, you know, I mean, this is actually one of the things, you know, credit where credit's due for our frenemy of show, Sohrab Amari, right? You know, he has a good article where he was, he's, that's like kind of a takedown of the NatCons, you know, the National Conservatives, where he's like, look, you know, you think that this is like nationalism is like the big thing that, you know, is the sort of like, you're really, you know, doing the return with a V, you know, with, you know, with that to this thing that comes before liberalism. This is this thing that came into the world with and grew up alongside liberalism.
All right. You guys claimed that historical part would be like 10 seconds and now it's, we're at like an hour. So
exactly. We're, Putin's first lie and hours too.
You guys are filibustering.
All right, well, let's go back to it.
This was the baptism of Russia when Prince Vladimir, the great grandson of Rurik, baptized Russia and adopted Orthodoxy or Eastern Christianity. From this time, the centralized Russian state began to strengthen. Why? Because of the single territory, integrated economic ties. One and the same language and, after the baptism of Russia, the same faith and rule of the prince. The centralized Russian state began to take shape. Back in the Middle Ages, Prince Yaroslav the Wise introduced the order of succession to a throne. But after he passed away, it became complicated for various reasons. The throne was passed not directly from father to eldest son, but from the prince who had passed away to his brother, then to his sons in different lines. All this led to the fragmentation and the end of Rus as a single state. There was nothing special about it. The same was happening then in Europe.
Но раздробленное русское государство стало легкой добычей.
But the fragmented Russian state became an easy prey to the empire created earlier by Genghis Khan. His successors, namely Batu Khan, came to Rus, plundered and ruined nearly all the cities. The southern part, including Kiev, by the way, and some other cities, simply lost independence, while northern cities preserved some of their sovereignty. They had to pay tribute to the horde, but they managed to preserve some part of their sovereignty. And then a unified Russian state began to take shape with its center in Moscow.
But
the southern part of Russian lands, including Kiev.
So he talks about the Mongol yoke, as it's typically referred to in Eastern European historiography, right? The period of Mongol Tatar occupation of Eastern Europe, especially Russia, in a very matter of fact way. He just kind of gets through it. And I want you to remember that when he begins to talk about other periods when Russia faced opponents. And to give you some context, when the Mongols came in, they stayed for something like 500 years. And the princes who maintained their sovereignty in the northern cities that Putin was describing, part of your succession rituals was going down to pay your respects to the Khan. And you literally had to dance a jig for his amusement. Occasionally, if a prince was too defiant, they would just be killed then and there. Sometimes they did everything they were expected to. They came with the appropriate tribute, the tax money. They were deferential. They did the jig and they'd be murdered anyway. The Mongol period was extraordinarily brutal. They were slavers, and Crimea, the Khanate of Crimea, was one of the successor states of the Golden Horde. It's estimated that over a period of 300 to 400 years, 1 million Slavic slaves were captured. And what this slave trade was very much like the root style, we're sending raiding parties, we're burning down your village, people get marched out in chains. That was happening all across the central Slavic heartland, the territories that are now Ukraine, eastern Poland, Russia as well. But Moscow, Kraków, other key political centers were also burned to the ground and destroyed in these raiding parties. So this is an extraordinarily vicious period. But, you know, he's just giving you the facts. I can respect that.
Yeah, I think that it seems like not out of the question that in a second Trump term, the jig thing could be part of the reception for
governors.
Yeah. Or you know,
Gretchen,
Lindsey Graham. Gretchen,
yeah. You've got nice legs. Maybe show a little more skin and do that again. Give us a twirl.
Yeah.
Bring back Sean Spicer just to dance.
Yeah, that feels right. All right.
Began to gradually gravitate towards another magnet, the center that was emerging in Europe. This was the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. It was even called the Lithuanian Russian Duchy, because Russians were a significant part of this population. They spoke the old Russian language and were Orthodox.
Again,
but then there was a unification, the union.
The Lithuanian Russian Duchy is, first of all, it's a Grand Duchy, not a regular duchy, asshole. Second of all,
you pass it to the left hand side, right?
The idea that it was thought of as a binational state, including Russians, it's incorrect, though there's some substance to it. It wasn't Lithuanian Russian state, but the term used was Ruthenian. And the Ruthenians were included speakers of the Western dialects of Eastern Slavic languages. So especially Ukrainians, but also people further south. There's a Ruthenian region in Slovakia, for instance. And that notion of a Lithuanian-Ruthenian merger or union was precisely because the population didn't want to define themselves as Russian. That was, he brings up Bogdan Khmelnytsky a little later, and that was a response to dissatisfaction among that Ruthenian population at the way that they were being treated in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania. But until the very last possible moment, they preferred to treat with the Kingdom of Poland for better conditions rather than just go over to the Tsar, go over to Russia, go over to the Muscovites.
I just got a quick question for you. Is this around the time when the church was trying to like unify the region by creating its own like written language?
This was after that happened.
Okay.
And by the church, the reason why Eastern Europe is split between countries that use the Latin alphabet, like English, and countries that use the backwards, scary
Cyrillic
alphabet, exactly, yeah, is because the Saints Methodius and Cyril were Orthodox missionaries from the Byzantine Empire. And in order to translate the Bible and, you know, civilize the unlettered Slavs, they developed their own alphabet based on Greek letters to transcribe spoken Russian, Ruthenian, Bulgarian, Serbian, right? All languages using the same alphabet created by Methodius and Cyril.
I mean, Serbian's a weird one because you have Croatian, which is essentially the same language that's just written into the Latin alphabet.
Exactly. And it's the difference between Catholic missionaries and Orthodox missionaries, because the Slavic people at that point, from the Baltic to the Adriatic to the Black Sea to the White Sea, were an illiterate people. So the literacy had to be introduced, and they took whatever was being offered to them by whichever group of missionaries was closest to them.
And of the Grand Duchy of Lithuania and the Kingdom of Poland.
All right, now he gave it its grant.
A few years later, another union was signed, but this time already in the religious sphere. Some of the Orthodox priests became subordinate to the Pope. Thus, these lands became part of the Polish-Lithuanian state.
That's a weird way of putting it.
The Poles were engaged in Polonization of this part of the population. They introduced their language there, tried to entrench the idea that this population was not exactly Russians.
Sorry, what were you saying there, Kuba?
So it's a strange way of putting it that it took the Union of Lublin, which was the merger of certain parts of the Orthodox Church in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, to the Church of Rome, the Catholic Church. What was, they still practiced the liturgy in their own language. They still did everything the same. But instead of answering to the Patriarch in Constantinople, they ultimately answered to the Pope. And if you ever hear the term Greek or Ukrainian Catholic, mm-hmm. that means people who practice Christianity in an Orthodox liturgy and according to an Orthodox tradition, but who recognize the Pope as the leader of the church overall.
Yeah,
and this happened significantly after the territories were included.
Yeah, their priests are allowed to get married, right?
Exactly. Honestly, if I were a Christian in Central Europe, that would probably be the most pragmatic choice to be, because your priests can marry, but you don't have to necessarily worry about all the weird Balkan and Russian theopolitics.
But because they lived on the fringe, they were Ukrainians. Originally, the word Ukrainian meant that the person was living on the outskirts of the state, along the fringes, or was engaged in a border patrol service.
The better term is frontier.
Didn't mean any particular ethnic group. So the Poles were trying to, in every possible way, to polonize this part of the Russian lands, and actually treated it rather harshly.
They're not Russian lands, cruelly. For the love of God.
All that led to the fact that this part of the Russian lands began to struggle for their rights. They wrote letters to Warsaw demanding that their rights be observed and people be commissioned here, including to Kiev.
I beg your pardon, can you tell us what period? I'm losing track of where in history we are. The Polish oppression of Ukraine.
It was in the
thank you, Tucker
century.
Carlson, for your historical contribution.
Now I will tell you what happened later and give the date so that there is no confusion. And in 1654, even a bit earlier, the people who were in control of the authority over that part of the Russian lands addressed Warsaw.
Again, not Russian lands.
Demanding
they had never been part of Russia. There had been no state called
Russian. Orthodox faith. When Warsaw did not answer them, and in fact rejected their demands,
also Warsaw wasn't even the fucking capital of Moscow. Poland took them away.
So that you don't think that I'm inventing things.
Oh my God, this is my favorite part.
Well, I it doesn't sound like you're inventing it. I'm not sure why it's relevant to what happened 2 years ago.
But still, these are documents from the archives, copies. Here are the letters from Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the man who then controlled the power in this part of the Russian lands that is now called Ukraine. He wrote to Warsaw demanding that their rights be upheld. And after being refused, he began to write letters to Moscow, asking to take them under the strong hand of the Moscow Tsar. There are copies of these documents. I will leave them for your good memory.
Okay, let's pause for a translation
into Russian.
So two things about this. I think a reasonable read of why he's making such a big deal about this, because this is such a bizarre moment in the interview that, like, it's like, oh, yeah, Tucker, you can go home and study original documents, you know? So, like, is that, you know, so this is from Igor Kakin, who's a Russian socialist, goes on shows, talks about the stuff, that, you know, essentially it seems like Putin is trying to, you know, like, presumably it's not just that he was trying to think of everything he could remember about this history and, like, you know, any relevant documents that were hanging around the archives, that that there's a analogy that he thinks exists here, that the the pro-Russian separatists in the Donbass, you know, asking for, you know, for his help in 2014. And that's, like, you know, what he's trying to push here, which of course is, you know, above and beyond anything else you could say about it. Like, I think is not something that should impress anybody that much. Cause it's like, yeah, right. I mean, it's like, look, throughout the entire duration of the war in Vietnam, the U.S. officials would tell you that they were there as, you know, on the request of their, you know, South Vietnamese allies, you know, that the, you know, you ask, saw Ryan Grimm point this out the other day, right? You asked John Kirby, you know, today, right? So, well, you know, Iraq is our ally. That's, you know, like, this tends to be, you know, the thing that imperial powers of a certain kind in the modern era do, right? That so it's not, you know, it seems to be that people take it more or less seriously depending on how they feel about the power in question. But anyway, putting all that aside, I think that's why he thinks this is actually relevant to the original subject of the interview. Because otherwise, it's just kind of amazing that he's like, you know, that he's like, you know, like, he had copies prepared of these documents. So Tucker Carlson's, mm-hmm. you know, team of, you know, Slavic history scholars could study them.
And I need to chime in about Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the leader that he was citing. First of all, not a Russian. Bogdan Khmelnytsky was a... he was a Cossack hetman who had been given the position by the Polish crown, and he spoke Polish fluently. It may have been his first language. He certainly spoke it better than he spoke Muscovite Russian. And the language among the people, Mongols have hordes, Cossacks have hosts. The Cossack host would speak Ukrainian or Ruthenian among themselves. They were not Russian. They did not consider themselves Russian. They considered themselves Cossacks. And their issue with the Polish crown came down to two things. One was the magnates, the grand aristocratic landholders in Lithuania, were they were dicks, and they were trying to essentially insert the Cossacks. The second was the matter of religion. The opinions differed in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, with some really fanatical Jesuit-style princes, kings at one point, and other lords that would repress the Orthodox, the practice of Orthodoxy. To be fair, it's not like the situation for Catholics was wonderful in Russia. The Khmelnytsky complained to Warsaw about his treatment and ultimately led a Cossack rebellion. The number one target was, of course, Jews. The anti-Semitism among the Cossacks. It's funny, because if Putin had decided to take a different tack, that, like, yes, Ukrainians exist and they're fundamentally Nazis, so we need to get rid of them, then Khmelnytsky would also be the guy you picked. He massacred tens of thousands of Poles and Jews based on their confession and ethnicity. And this period in Polish history is considered to be an utter catastrophe. All of the eastern lands were burned over through this constant warfare between the Cossack host and the Polish-Lithuanian crown. The Polish king tried several times to mediate, and ultimately the Ukrainian Cossacks were able to succeed only by enlisting not only the Muscovites, but also the Crimean Tatars, the slaving people that bedeviled the entire region, onto their side. And this is a weird moment to emphasize, and Bogdan Khmelnytsky is a weird figure to elevate, because the Ukrainian Nazis, right, that are the sort of sworn enemies of Putin, they also select him as their legitimating progenitor. But from a Ukrainian nationalist rather than a Russian nationalist narrative.
Yeah. And he is going to go back to the Ukrainian Nazis later in the, later in the interview. I was actually kind of surprised when I saw that clip. It's like, oh, we're still doing the denazification line. Okay. That seems very 2022.
You can translate it into English later. Russia would not agree to admit them straight away, assuming that the war with Poland would start. Nevertheless, in 1654, the Pan-Russian Assembly of Top Clergy and Landowners.
All right, we're up to 1654. We're getting so close to 2022.
Which was the representative body of the power of the old Russian state, decided to include a part of the old Russian lands into Moscow Kingdom. As expected, the war with Poland began. It lasted 13 years, and then in 1654, a truce was concluded. And 32 years later, I think, a peace treaty with Poland, which they called Eternal Peace, was signed. And these lands, the whole left bank of Dnieper, including Kiev, went to Russia. And the whole right bank of Dnieper remained in Poland. Under the rule of Catherine the Great, Russia reclaimed all of its historical lands, including in the south and west.
What does he mean by historical Russian lands?
Before World War One,
there are territories that
Austrian
were never
general
in
staff
Russian
relied
hands.
On the
they
ideas
simply conquered
of,
them.
Yeah, and especially, if anything, I think the even zanier phrase than Russian lands there is reclaimed, right? Like, you can't reclaim something for the first, you have to have previously claimed it to then reclaim it. Hence but yeah, I mean, it does really show, like, how much, even with this, like, much of this stuff is in his head. I mean, like, how strange and anachronistic, you know, the way that, you know, that sort of tried to spin this kind of ethno-nationalist narrative, you know, back to the 1600s ends up getting.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that if he calls shotgun, he does not reclaim your car seat.
No. Yeah, I mean,
he licked Lugansk back in 952. So, you know, that was his after.
Okay.
No matter what happens.
Yeah. No. Fair enough.
Ukrainianization and started actively promoting the ideas of Ukraine and the Ukrainianization. Their motive was obvious. Just before World War I, they wanted to weaken the potential enemy and secure themselves favorable conditions in the border area. So the idea which had emerged in Poland that people residing in that territory were allegedly not really Russians, but rather belonged to a special ethnic group, Ukrainians, started being propagated by the Austrian general staff. As far back as the 19th century, theorists calling for Ukrainian independence appeared. All those, however, claim that Ukraine should have a very good relationship with Russia. They insisted on that. After the 1917 revolution, the Bolsheviks sought to restore the statehood and the civil war began, including the hostilities with Poland. In 1921, peace with Poland was proclaimed, and under that treaty, the right bank of Dnieper River once again was given back to Poland.
It's funny, because
in 1939, now, after Poland
gets territory back, it's not this glorious reclamation of land that's naturally Polish. It's this grudging concession in order to gain peace. But what he's also doing here is he's setting up his proposal, which you'll hear later on, which is that Ukraine doesn't exist. We'll take the left bank, which has always been ours, which has always been Russia. Then we'll take a bunch of other stuff that we want. And Poland, right bank is all yours.
Operated with Hitler.
Could you rewind a little, because I just heard Hitler. You know?
Yeah, same.
In 1921, peace with Poland was proclaimed, and under that treaty, the right bank of Dnieper River once again was given back to Poland. In 1939, after Poland cooperated with Hitler,
this is obscene.
Collaborate with Hitler, you know? Hitler offered Poland peace.
And okay. Did he say in 1921 when Poland collaborated with Hitler?
That's what I heard, but it seems like that can't possibly be what he meant. But the part at the end there, just before we paused, and actually maybe we should like listen to a little bit more of this before we comment on this, but it's like I think the really grotesque distortion is that like last sentence about, you know, about Hitler offering Poland peace, but I really want to hear exactly what he says about this. So let's listen to that a minute.
An alliance demanding in return that Poland give back to Germany the so-called Danzig Corridor, which connected the bulk of Germany with East Prussia and Königsberg. After World War I, this territory was transferred to Poland, and instead of Danzig, a city of Gdansk emerged. Hitler asked them to give it amicably, but they refused.
Of course.
Still, they collaborated with Hitler and engaged together in the partitioning of Czechoslovakia.
May I ask you, you're making the case that Ukraine, certainly parts of Ukraine, Eastern Ukraine, is in effect Russia has been for...
Okay, let's pause.
Why wouldn't you...
Because Tucker... Tucker, to give the man his due, has actually tried to steer this into something with contemporary relevance, but I don't know how successful he's about to be in that, but like it is worth pausing on that thing about Poland and World War II, since this really is, Kuba can still tell us more than I can, but like, you know, this happens to be fresh in my mind since, I'll often listen to, audiobooks while I'm, washing dishes and walking the dog and driving to campus and all that stuff. And Audible's algorithms have correctly detected that I'm an American man entering my mid-40s, and thus am probably primed to listen to a 56-hour book about World War II. And so it recently recommended William Scherer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, which I actually just finished. So the stuff about the lead up to the invasion of Poland is fairly fresh in my mind. And the idea that the idea that Hitler was sort of gunning for like an amicable diplomatic resolution of various outstanding issues, I think is not very accurate, but maybe it's worth unpacking this a bit.
So Poland was the first country invaded by Hitler, and meaning actual fighting rather than sort of diplomatic betrayal or occupation, like in Austria or Czechoslovakia. The World War II, we can be very sensitive. The left can be very sensitive to historical traumas for certain groups. For instance, you mentioned the Nakba, and everyone will immediately accede to that narrative of dispossession, trauma, brutalization that it now is it defines Palestinian history and identity. And no one would dismiss it. It's rightly recognized as one of the keys to understanding that conflict. Similarly, when other groups, other minority groups, or smaller nations are targeted by powerful imperial forces, colonizers, what have you, there is a sensitivity and an appreciation for their victimhood and suffering. World War II is about as terrible a period of historical suffering, World War II in Poland, as any country has ever endured. Poland, by percentage of its pre-war population, I believe is the number one, the number one charnel house of all of Eastern, of the entire war. Approximately 3 million Polish Jews and about 3 million Polish Gentiles were killed during the conflict. Not all of them by Nazi Germany either. Many of them were killed by the Soviets. The entire country was ravaged and destroyed. And unlike a place like France or the Netherlands, where the post-war period gave them a chance to reestablish some kind of sovereignty, Poland went from one totalitarian occupation, the Third Reich, to another, the USSR. The attitude of the contempt, right, and loathing that Putin has shown for Poland and so far in this interview, and he'll do it again, don't worry, is nothing new. The USSR likewise considered Poles to be suspect, right? Counter-revolutionary just on the basis of their national identity, to the point that when the NKVD was rounding up people to meet its repression quotas during the height of Stalinist repression, they would just pick people out of the Moscow and Leningrad phone books that had Polish names, because their being Polish was enough of a justification to send them to camps or to execute them. So the suffering that Poland experienced as a result of the war is central to the Polish notion of itself and to, frankly, the lived experience, if I may use the term, of Poles themselves. I would not be in Canada. I would not have my life, my actual life and the lives of everyone I know have been shaped, have been lived in the shadow of the slaughter and repression of the Third Reich and the Soviet Union. Now, the Nazi plan for Poland, as spelled out in Generalplan Ost, and as well as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, was absolute genocide. The elimination of the entire educated stratum of Poles that might serve as some kind of nucleus for resistance, and the death by slavery and overwork of the remaining population. That was the Nazi plan. The Soviet plan was to Russify as much territory as possible and turn Poland into, I'll say it, like a little Gaza or a giant Gaza, right? You couldn't leave. Your entire economy was subordinate to 5-year plans coming out of Moscow. And all aspects of life were under direct management by a communist party that ultimately was subordinate again to the Soviet Union. So out of all of this darkness, one of the few points of comfort, one of the few sources of comfort for Polish people is that, unlike certain other countries in this period that made deals with Nazi Germany, you know, I'm looking at you, France and the UK sold out Czechoslovakia, for instance. IBM sold the Third Reich, the computers that they used to manage the Holocaust. You had collaborationist governments in a number of Western European countries. But because Poland was considered to be the ancestral enemy of the Aryan people and a racially inferior ethnic group, Hitler overruled his own advisors about working with Poles. There was no collaborationist government in Poland during the war. And before the war, the government of Poland, which was basically a nationalist dictatorship, understood full well the danger that the Third Reich posed and the level of enmity that it felt for them. Unfortunately, that was reflected in a similarly murderous intent from the USSR. So there was a non-aggression pact signed with Nazi Germany in 1932 or 1934, but there was also one signed with the USSR in 2 years later. It was just part of the diplomacy of the period to try to give Poland some breathing room to be able to protect itself. And there's a reason why that's not the best known Nazi non-aggression pact with an Eastern European power, right? You should be careful, Vladimir, right? Glass houses and all that.
Yeah. I mean, the Czechoslovakia thing is true, right? That they,
I was getting to that. So when Hitler annexed Czechoslovakia and ruled in, there were a couple of territorial disputes, a couple of disputed areas between Poland and Czechoslovakia. Poland was not a party. They didn't plan the dismemberment of Czechoslovakia. They weren't invited to Berlin and shown a map. Once the tanks started rolling in, opportunistically, and perhaps dishonorably, they grabbed the little bits that they had a claim to because, well, one, they wanted them, and two, even from the Czech perspective, the Czech or Slovak perspective, maybe better the Poles than Hitler. So opportunism, yes. Collaboration, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And the only reason that you would put this, and the only reason that you would frame it this way, is as a deliberate provocation towards polls. Nobody else cares. Nobody else will quibble over these issues. Many people, like Tucker Carlson, will simply sit there with that expression and allow these calumnies and insults to Polish national honor just stand. But these are false. And Putin is perhaps hoping to detach Poland from other NATO powers in Central Europe, for instance, Hungary, by, you know, it would be like me telling you all about your grandfather's Klan membership. Mm-hmm. Yeah, did he stop at regular wizard or did he go all the way to that imperial wizard? You know, and how many, remind me, was it dozens or hundreds of black people he lynched?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, this is actually the more charitable interpretation of the point of him bringing this up, right? Because the only reasons I could think of for him to do this detour into Poland to World War II, which doesn't even bear, you know, at least what he said, you know, said as of when Tucker cut him off, the sort of larger narrative he was kind of tediously building up before, are either as like, you know, the fuck you to Poland, you know, because of its involvement in NATO and et cetera, and maybe even the sort of line about Czechoslovakia is like an attempt to be like, oh, see, you collaborated with the bad enemy people before. So that's like the relatively more charitable one. The really insane interpretation would be like, yeah, see, they didn't give the Donetsk corridor. They're being unreasonable, just like Ukrainians being unreasonable, right? Which would be, you know, the reason that would be the less charitable one is that he would be Hitler in this analogy.
Exactly. And, you know, what did that guy even do, right? The mean Poles just forced him into this by being so obstinate, but they were also somehow collaborating with him.
Yeah. I don't think it's a very hot take that Adolf Hitler wasn't really a good faith negotiator, but if you do, I just finished reading Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, so, you know, happens to be fresh in my mind, right? Like, you know, it seems very, very clear that, like, all this stuff about the goal wasn't to just get the Donetsk corridor. The goal was to do what he'd previously done with Czechoslovakia and had previously done it a different way with the Anschluss of Austria, which was to use a pretext. Yeah. Yeah. To come up with a bunch of grievances that he could push and like sort of keep on escalating demands so that, you know, so he could claim that, you know, he wasn't being, you know, met halfway, and then eventually, you know, you manufacture some incidents, et cetera. You know, like that was like the goal was, as with Austria and Czechoslovakia, the goal was to take over the country, ideally in the way that he'd done those other countries without actually having to do a shooting war.
And absolutely. And there's something else about stealth occupation that I want to bring up. The Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact signed between Hitler and Stalin had a secret clause dividing up the territory of Eastern Europe. Poland would be split into an Eastern Soviet occupation zone and a Western Nazi occupation zone. It also included a mutual commitment by both parties to eliminating the entire Polish leadership class and pledging that the name Poland would never appear again on a map of Europe. When the Nazis invaded from the West, once it became clear that the Poles would not be able to, would not receive any support from the Western allies, that there was not going to be a French invasion of the Rhineland, the Soviet Union marched in without a declaration of a war. The Polish forces in the territories that they occupied surrendered to them peacefully. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of men, right? Because the entire country had been mobilized for the conflict. Regular rank and file soldiers were sent to prisoner of war camps, but were treated well in a very civilized way. However, tens of thousands of officers or individuals that were considered to be anti-Soviet, possibly just on the basis of being notable, right? A professor, an athlete, an actor, anybody who could potentially rally opposition for the occupation, they were taken by the NKVD, brought to, some of them were taken to prisons, some of them were taken to the Katyn forest or other parts of the wilderness, and executed, often after being tortured for days. Tens of thousands. And these people had done nothing wrong, right? They were completely innocent. They had surrendered peacefully to the Soviets. They had not undertaken any kind of anti-Soviet activity. And the Soviet policy mirrored what the Nazis were doing in their part of Poland, rounding up professors, rounding up any trade unionists, socialists. Incidentally, that's what the Soviets were doing, too. If you were a non-Moscow-aligned socialist, or perhaps a Moscow-aligned socialist who had a little too much local profile, you were killed. You were executed. So I see in the comments some people mentioning that the Red Army paid an enormous price in liberating Poland from the Third Reich, that they do I give any credit to the Soviets for, you know, coming in and saving Eastern Poland from Nazi occupation? The short answer is, from the perspective of the greater war, absolutely. The USSR was a heroic participant, and ultimately victory over the Third Reich came as a result of the heroism and the sacrifice, the enormous sacrifice of the people of the Soviet Union, without a doubt. Poland was never liberated. Poland went from being conquered by the Third Reich to being conquered by the USSR. We owe them no gratitude for that. If the tanks stay and the people don't want them to, then you haven't liberated anybody. So I understand the geopolitical reasons why the Soviet Union would want a buffer zone deep into Europe in order to protect itself from another Operation Barbarossa. I understand the geopolitics of international
competition. But it's also, you know, can also maybe understand that most people don't like to be used as a buffer, just precisely, kind of on the face of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. But the thought. Just yeah. My last point. And this, in some ways, the Poland has, of course, a fraught relationship with Russia. It also has a very challenging history with its German neighbor. The Germans, and there's an interesting difference between the two. Germans are culturally much more distant than Russians. While administratively, Poland, as part of the EU, is closer politically with Germany. And the Germans are tone deaf at cultural diplomacy. They don't really know how to talk to Poles about this kind of stuff, the history, the purpose, the meaning. Putin, and this is what makes it so personal, he knows exactly the Polish soul in the same way that he later referenced the Russian soul. He knows how provocative, how triggering, how painful this is, and how dishonest it is. The contrast between his description of Poland now and the fact that he invited Polish leaders to visit Katyn Forest, he apologized and took responsibility for the Katyn Forest massacre. He directed Russian state TV after the airplane disaster that killed Lech Kaczynski and 96 other Polish figures. He directed Russian state television to broadcast Andrzej Wajda's historical drama Katyn so that the Russian people would know, would understand. And therefore, he knows exactly what he's doing, right? This is the kind of hurtful, right? The kind of offense that can only come from somebody who knows you well enough. And therefore, it's all the worst. And likewise, how much can you trust this guy who presents these grand historical narratives as being the justification, the source for his geopolitics, but depending on what he's trying to do at a given moment, the entire history can change overnight.
Yeah, that's fair. Grand nationalistic historical narratives do tend to be like that in general. With regards to the stuff in the chat and, we should get back to it. Really hoping we could at least finish. I'm really hoping we could get up to 2022 tonight, but my last comment on World War II would just be that it shouldn't be this, this difficult, it shouldn't be that hard to sort of walk and chew bubblegum intellectually on this, right? To say that it's, victory of the victory of the Soviet Union in World War II, against fascism was a very good thing, but also Stalinism is really bad. And you should be able to hold both of those thoughts in your head without too much trouble.
Just take it. When you became president 24 years ago, you have nuclear weapons. They don't. If it's actually your land, why did you wait so long?
Sure.
No, I'll tell you. I'm coming to that. This briefing is coming to an end. It might be boring, but it explains many things.
I just don't know how it's relevant.
Good. Good. I'm so gratified that you appreciate that. Thank you. So, before World War II, Poland collaborated with Hitler, and although it did not yield to Hitler's demands, it still participated in the partitioning of Czechoslovakia together with Hitler, as the Poles had not given the Danzig corridor to Germany and went so far, pushing Hitler to start World War II by attacking them. Why was it Poland against whom the war started on 1st September 1939? Poland turned out to be uncompromising, and Hitler had nothing to do but start implementing
his plans with Poland.
By the way, the USSR, I have read some archived documents, behaved very honestly. It asked Poland's permission to transit its troops through the Polish territory to help Czechoslovakia.
Which would have ended.
But the then Polish foreign minister said that
they were just trying to do a Hitler to Poland from the east, right? The troops that would have they would have never made it to Czechoslovakia because they would have been too busy securing Lwów, Kraków, and Warsaw.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's unknowable, but the later track record certainly doesn't fill you with confidence they wouldn't have done that.
But if the Soviet planes flew over Poland, they would be downed over the territory of Poland. But that doesn't matter. What matters is that the war began, and Poland fell prey to the policies it had pursued against Czechoslovakia, as under the well-known Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. Part of the territory, including Western Ukraine, was to be given to Russia. Thus, Russia, which was then named the USSR, regained its historical lands. After the victory in the Great Patriotic War, as we call World
War II, sorry, just for a second.
All those theories.
Really do have to stop in awe at that turn of phrase, Russia, whose name then was the USSR. Wait, what? Right? That's not right. USSR was Russian dominated in many ways, which is important. But it's like this is the. But I think it does tell you something about the way that all previous history is sort of opportunistically melded into this nationalistic narrative, right? That you know, that like the Russian Federation is basically the same thing as the entire multinational USSR is basically the same thing as the, you know, Kiev and Rus, you know, hundreds of years before, you know, there was a written Russian language, you know, it's all the same except for when it's not, you know, insofar as it like serves whatever narrative, you know, you want to advance in a given moment.
Territories will ultimately enshrine this belonging to Russia, to the USSR. As for Poland, it received, apparently in compensation, the lands which had originally been German. The eastern parts of Germany,
the narrative these are now western lands of Poland, presented to the Poles for this territorial transfer. Specifically referred to the areas of Germany that were ceded to Poland as the regained lands, right? The Polish state reclaiming its ancestral territory. Not really true, but this type of argumentation from historical narrative in order to make land claims, that's 100%. Par for the course. That's a very long tradition of that in Russian foreign policy.
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of amazing that one thing that Putin has in common with like the most like brain dead anti-Russia lib is that both of them sort of see everything, you know, Catherine the Great, the Soviet Union under Andropov, you know, whatever. It's all just like one big thing, you know, with no important differences between any of them.
Of course, Poland regained access to the Baltic Sea and Danzig, which was once again given its Polish name. So this was how this situation developed. In 1922, when the USSR was being established, the Bolsheviks started building the USSR and established the Soviet Ukraine, which had never existed before.
Right.
Stalin insisted that those republics be included in the USSR as autonomous entities. For some inexplicable reason, Lenin, the founder of the Soviet state, insisted that they be entitled to withdraw from the USSR. And again, for some unknown reasons, he transferred to that newly established Soviet Republic of Ukraine some of the lands together with people living there, even though those lands had never been called Ukraine, and yet they were made part of that Soviet Republic of Ukraine. Those lands included the Black Sea region, which was received under Catherine the Great, and which had no historical connection with Ukraine whatsoever. Even if we go as far back as 1654, when these lands returned to Russian Empire, that territory was the size of 3 to 4 regions of modern Ukraine, with no Black Sea region. That was completely out of the question.
In 1654.
Exactly.
You obviously have encyclopedic knowledge of this region, but why didn't you make this case for the first 22 years as president that Ukraine wasn't a real country?
Советская Украина получила...
The Soviet Union was given a great deal of territory that had never belonged to it, including the Black Sea region.
He just decided he wasn't going to.
At some point, when Russia received them as an outcome of the Russo-Turkish Wars, they were called New Russia or Novorossiya. But that does not matter. What matters is that Lenin, the founder of the Soviet state, established Ukraine that way. For decades, the Ukrainian Soviet Republic developed as part of the USSR. And for unknown reasons, again, the Bolsheviks were engaged in Ukrainianization. It was not merely because the Soviet leadership was composed to a great extent of those originating from Ukraine. Rather, it was explained by the general policy of indigenization pursued by the Soviet Union. Same things were done in other Soviet republics. This involved promoting national languages and national cultures, which is not a bad in principle. That is how the Soviet Ukraine was created. After the World War II, Ukraine received, in addition to the lands that had belonged to Poland before the war, part of the lands that had previously belonged to Hungary and Romania. So Romania and Hungary had some of their lands taken away and given to the Soviet Ukraine, and they still remain part of Ukraine. So in this sense, we have every reason to affirm that Ukraine is an artificial state that was shaped at Stalin's will.
Do you believe Hungary has a right to take its land back from Ukraine? And that other nations have a right to go back to their 1654 borders?
I'm not sure whether they should go back to the 1654 borders. But given Stalin's time, so-called Stalin's regime, which as many claim saw numerous violations of human rights and violations of the rights of other states, one may say that they could claim back those lands of theirs while having no right to do that. It is at least understandable.
Have you told Viktor Orban that he can have part of Ukraine?
Никогда не говорил.
Never. I have never told him, not a single time.
У нас с ним даже на этот счет не было никаких разговоров.
We have not even had any conversation on that, but I actually know for sure that Hungarians who live there wanted to get back to their historical land. Moreover, I would like to share a very interesting story with you. I digress, it's a personal one. Somewhere in the early 80s, I went on a road trip in a car from then Leningrad across the Soviet Union through Kiev, made a stop in Kiev, and then went to western Ukraine. I went to the town of Biregovoye, and all the names of towns and villages there were in Russian and in a language I did not understand, in Hungarian. In Russian and in Hungarian. Not in Ukrainian, in Russian and in Hungarian. I was driving through some kind of village and there were men sitting next to the houses and they were wearing black three-piece suits and black cylinder hats. I asked, are they some kind of entertainers? I was told, no, they were not entertainers, they're Hungarians. I said, what are they doing here? What do you mean? This is their land. They live here. This was during the Soviet time in the 1980s. They preserved the Hungarian language, Hungarian names, and all their national costumes. They are Hungarians, and they feel themselves to be Hungarians. And of course, when now there is an infringement.
Well, that is, and there's a lot of that, though. I think many nations are upset about Transylvania as well, as you obviously know. But many nations feel frustrated by the redrawn borders of the wars of the 20th century. And wars going back 1,000 years, the ones that you mentioned. But the fact is that you didn't make this case in public until 2 years ago, February. And in the case that you made, which I read today, you explain at great length that you felt a physical threat from the West in NATO, including potentially a nuclear threat. And that's what got you to move. Is that a fair characterization of what you said?
I understand that my long speeches probably fall outside of the genre of the interview. That is why I asked you at the beginning, are we going to have a serious talk or a show? You said a serious talk. So bear with me, please. We're coming to the point where the Soviet Ukraine was established. Then, in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed, and everything that Russia had generously bestowed on Ukraine was dragged away by the latter. I'm coming to a very important point of today's agenda.
Thank you.
After all, the collapse of the Soviet Union was effectively initiated by the Russian leadership.
тогда руководствовалось руководство России. Но
I do not understand what the Russian leadership was guided by at the time, but I suspect there were several reasons to think everything would be fine.
Первое. Ну, во-первых, я думаю, что руководство России исходило из того, что фундаментальные...
First, I think that then Russian leadership believed that the fundamentals of the relationship between Russia and Ukraine were, in fact, a common language. More than 90% of the population there spoke Russian. Family ties. Every third person there had some kind of family or friendship ties. Common culture. Common history. Finally, common faith, coexistence with a single state for centuries, and deeply interconnected economies.
That single state being, of course, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth.
All these elements together make our good relationships inevitable. The second point is a very important one. I want you, as an American citizen and your viewers, to hear about this as well. The former Russian leadership assumed that the Soviet Union had ceased to exist, and therefore there were no longer any ideological dividing lines. Russia even agreed voluntarily and proactively to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and believed that this would be understood by the so-called civilized West as an invitation for cooperation and association. That is what Russia was expecting, both from the United States and the so-called collective West as a whole. There were smart people, including in Germany, Egon Bahr, a major politician of the Social Democratic Party, who insisted in his personal conversations with the Soviet leadership on the brink of the collapse of the Soviet Union, that a new security system should be established in Europe. Help should be given to unify Germany, but a new system should be also established to include the United States, Canada, Russia, and other Central European countries.
Yes.
But NATO needs not to expand. That's what he said. If NATO expands, everything would be just the same as during the Cold War, only closer to Russia's borders. That's all. He was a wise old man, but no one listened to him. In fact, he got angry once. If, he said, you don't listen to me, I'm never setting my foot in Moscow once again. Everything happened just as he had said.
Well, of course, it did come true, and you've mentioned this many times. I think it's a fair point, and many in America thought that relations between Russia and the United States would be fine with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War. That the opposite happened, but you've never explained why you think that happened, except to say that the West fears a strong Russia, but we have a strong China. The West does not seem very afraid of. What about Russia? Do you think convinced policymakers they had to take it down?
The West is afraid of strong China more than it fears a strong Russia, because Russia has 150 million people and China has 1.5 billion population, and its economy is growing by leaps and bounds, or 5% a year. It used to be even more. But that's enough for China. As Bismarck once put it, potentials are the most important. China's potential is enormous. It is the biggest economy in the world today in terms of purchasing power parity and the size of the economy. It has already overtaken the United States quite a long time ago, and it is growing at a rapid clip. Let's not talk about who is afraid of whom. Let's not reason in such terms. And let's get into the fact that after 1991, when Russia expected that it would be welcomed into the brotherly family of civilized nations, nothing like this happened. You tricked us. I don't mean you personally when I say you. Of course, I'm talking about the United States. The promise was that NATO would not expand eastward, but it happened five times. There were five waves of expansion. We tolerated all that. We were trying to persuade them. We were saying, please don't. We are as bourgeois now as you are. We are market economy and there's no communist party power. Let's negotiate. Moreover, I have also said this publicly before. There was a moment when a certain rift started growing between us. Before that, Yeltsin came to the United States. Remember, he spoke in Congress and said the good words. God bless America. Everything he said were signals. Let us in. Remember the developments in Yugoslavia before the Yeltsin was lavished with praise? As soon as the developments in Yugoslavia started, he raised his voice in support of Serbs, and we couldn't but raise our voices for Serbs in their defense. I understand that there were complex processes underway there, I do, but Russia could not help raising its voice in support of Serbs, because Serbs are also a special and close to us nation, with Orthodox culture and so on. It's a nation that has suffered so much for generations. Well, regardless, what is important is that Yeltsin expressed his support. What did the United States do? In violation of international law and the UN Charter, it started bombing Belgrade. It was the United States that let the genie out of the bottle. Moreover, when Russia protested and expressed its resentment, what was said? The UN Charter and international law have become obsolete. Now everyone invokes international law, but at that time they started saying that everything was outdated. Everything had to be changed. Indeed, some things need to be changed, as the balance of power has changed. It's true, but not in this manner. Yeltsin was immediately dragged through the mud, accused.
I just want to say one thing about this characterization of international affairs during the post-Soviet period, the Yeltsin period, the expansion of NATO, Putin's account of the Yugoslav war. I agree with all of it. I think that that's actually a pretty fair description of what happened. I'll call him out when I feel he's falsifying the historical record, but I'm perfectly willing to let all of this stand. It seems more or less accurate.
You know, I mean, I do think that the, you know, I mean, it depends, I guess, on the context of the discussion. You know, I would point out that, that, you know, if you're going to talk about, you know, Yugoslavia, that, you know, there's some pretty important context about some of what was going on there that makes the, you know, makes, you know, Russian foreign policy there, you know, like puts it in a much worse light, right? Like given some of what Serbia was up to. But if you, so I think that's true, but like also, yeah, I mean, I think the sort of larger story that he's telling about, you know, about NATO expansion, about, the, you know, the way that the, you know, about, you know, U.S. intervention, I mean, that's also, you know, that's also true. And it's, and, you know, it is really striking, right? Cause he could have actually started with all this, right? Like there's literally no reason that what he's saying now couldn't have been in the first 5 minutes of the interview, right? Like, you know, like he, when he said, I'm going to do 30 seconds and, you know, take you through some history. Like, I mean, you know, he didn't have to go back to the, to 1654. Well, you know, the earliest stuff he said was much earlier than 1654, but you know, he didn't have to do that, right? He could have started in 1991 and, you know, frankly, probably would have played much better with most of Tucker Carlson's audience.
Yeah. I think that the, that early section was to provoke the Poles to imply some kind of territorial advantage for the Hungarians and to undermine the kind of unity of purpose of the backers of Ukraine, right? Because it becomes a nationalist story rather than this we're fighting totalitarian story. And as I can demonstrate myself, this is going to bait Poles into defending their own nationalists, their own particular narrative, their own national honor. So I think that it also makes him appear. And you can see this in responses from commentators on the left all over the world. This makes Putin seem professorial, intelligent. It allows him to absolutely dominate Tucker Carlson intellectually. But yeah, that was from the perspective of actually talking about the war. It's a kind of lengthy throat clearing.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's either completely irrelevant, which is what Tucker, you know, I mean, to his credit, has been coming in about once every 10 minutes to suggest. Or if it is relevant, it's relevant in a way that should put Putin in a horrible light, right? Because if it's relevant, right, that suggests that the war isn't being fought for, you know, sort of comprehensible 2020s relevant, achievable aims, but it's been fought because of this like grandiose narrative about Ukraine not being a real country that, like, you know, it's like, well, shit. I mean, if that's the reason, then I guess I've got to switch positions on this, right? Like, cause I'm all for de-escalation and diplomacy. If there's like a way of like actually solving this thing, that you could actually conceivably get everybody to agree to. But, you know, if it's just that, we just have to assert Russian dominance over everything because of something, something Kiev and Rus, something, something Mongols, then, like, I don't know, man. I guess maybe now I'm, you know, like if I took that seriously, right, then it's like, I guess now I'm in the, you know, Ann Applebaum camp about this, right? That, like, I guess there is no reasonable negotiated settlement. So, like, it's a very weird thing that he would, you know, that he would front load that, at least in terms of thinking about reactions in the West.
Used of alcoholism, of understanding nothing, of knowing nothing. He understood everything, I assure you. Well, I became president in 2000. I thought, okay, the Yugoslav issue is over, but we should try to restore relations. Let's reopen the door that Russia had tried to go through. And moreover, I said it publicly, I can reiterate. At a meeting here in the Kremlin with the outgoing president Bill Clinton, right here in the next room, I said to him, I asked him, Bill, do you think if Russia asked to join NATO, do you think it would happen? Suddenly he said, you know, it's interesting. I think so. But in the evening, when we met for dinner, he said, you know, I've talked to my team. No, it's not possible now. You can ask him. I think he will watch our interview. He'll confirm it. I wouldn't have said anything like that if it hadn't happened. Okay.
Were you sincere?
It's impossible now.
Would you have joined NATO?
Look, I asked the question, is it possible or not? And the answer I got was no. If I was insincere in my desire to find out what the leadership position was...
But if he had said yes, would you have joined NATO?
If he had said yes, the process of rapprochement would have commenced, and eventually it might have happened if we had seen some sincere wish on the other side of our partners. But it didn't happen. Well, no means no. Okay, fine.
Why do you think that is? Just to get to motive, I know you're clearly bitter about it. I understand. But why do you think the West rebuffed you then? Why the hostility? Why did the end of the Cold War not fix the relationship? What motivates this from your point of view?
You said I was bitter about the answer. No, it's not bitterness. It's just a statement of fact. We're not bride and groom, bitterness, resentment. It's not about those kind of matters in such circumstances. We just realized we weren't welcome there. That's all. Okay, fine. But let's build relations in another manner. Let's work for common ground elsewhere. Why we received such a negative response, you should ask your leaders. I can only guess why. Too big a country with its own opinion and so on. And the United States, I've seen how issues are being resolved in NATO.
видел, как решают.
I will give you another example now concerning Ukraine. The US leadership exerts pressure, and all NATO members obediently vote, even if they do not like something. Now, I'll tell you what happened in this regard with Ukraine in 2008, although it's being discussed. I'm not going to open a secret to you, say anything new. Nevertheless, after that we tried to build relations in different ways. For example, the events in the Middle East, in Iraq. We were building relations with the United States in a very soft, prudent, cautious manner. I repeatedly raised the issue that the United States should not support separatism or terrorism in the North Caucasus. But they continue to do it anyway. And political support, information support, financial support, even military support came from the United States and its satellites for terrorist groups in the Caucasus. I once raised this issue with my colleague, also the President of the United States. He says, "It's impossible. Do you have proof?" I said, "Yes." I was prepared for this conversation, and I gave him that proof. He looked at it, and you know what he said? I apologize, but that's what happened. I'll quote. He says, "Well, I'm gonna kick their ass." We waited and waited for some response. There was no reply. I said to the FSB director, "Write to the CIA. What is the result of the conversation with President?" He wrote once, twice, and then we got a reply. We have the answer in the archive. The CIA replied, "We have been working with the opposition in Russia. We believe that this is the right thing to do, and we will keep on doing it." Just ridiculous. Well, okay. We realized that it was out of the question.
Forces in opposition to you. So you're saying the CIA is trying to overthrow your government.
Of course, they meant in that particular case the separatists, the terrorists who fought with us in the Caucasus. That's who they called the opposition. This is the second point. The third moment is a very important one. It's the moment when the U.S. missile defense system was created. The beginning. We persuaded for a long time not to do it in the United States. Moreover, after I was invited by Bush Jr.'s father, Bush Sr., to visit his place on the ocean, I had a very serious conversation with President Bush and his team. I proposed that the United States, Russia, and Europe jointly create a missile defense system that we believe, if created unilaterally, threatens our security, despite the fact that the United States officially said that it was being created against missile threats from Iran. That was the justification for the deployment of the missile defense system. I suggested working together, Russia, the United States, and Europe. They said it was very interesting. They asked me, "Are you serious?" I said, "Absolutely."
Let me ask, what year was this?
I don't remember. It is easy to find out on the internet when I was in the USA at the invitation of Bush Sr. It is even easier to learn from someone I'm going to tell you about. I was told it was very interesting. I said, "Just imagine if we could tackle such a global strategic security challenge together. The world will change. We'll probably have disputes, probably economic and even political ones, but we could drastically change the situation in the world." He says, "Yes," and asks, "Are you serious?" I said, "Of course. We need to think about it," I'm told. I said, "Go ahead, please." Then Secretary of Defense Gates, former director of CIA and Secretary of State Rice, came in here, in this cabinet, right here at this table. They sat on this table. Me, the foreign minister, the Russian defense minister on that side. They said to me, "Yes, we have thought about it. We agree." I said, "Thank God, great, but with some exceptions."
So twice you've described U.S. presidents making decisions and then being undercut by their agency heads. So it sounds like you're describing a system that's not run by the people who are elected in your telling.
That's right. That's right. In the end, they just told us to get lost. I'm not going to tell you the details because I think it's incorrect. After all, it was confidential conversation. But our proposal was declined. That's a fact. It was right then when I said, look, but then we will be forced to take countermeasures. We will create such strike systems that will certainly overcome missile defense systems. The answer was, we are not doing this against you, and you do what you want, assuming that it is not against us, not against the United States. I said, okay. Very well. That's the way it went. And we created hypersonic systems with intercontinental range, and we continue to develop them. We are now ahead of everyone, the United States and the other countries, in terms of the development of hypersonic strike systems, and we are improving them every day. But it wasn't us. We proposed to go the other way, and we were pushed back. Now, about NATO's expansion to the east. Well, we were promised no NATO to the east, not an inch to the east, as we were told. And then what? They said, well, it's not enshrined on paper, so we'll expand. So there were five waves of expansion, the Baltic states, the whole of Eastern Europe, and so on. And now I come to the main thing. They have come to the Ukraine, ultimately. In 2008, at the summit in Bucharest, they declared that the doors for Ukraine and Georgia to join NATO were open. Now about how decisions are made there. Germany, France seem to be against it, as well as some other European countries. But then, as it turned out, later, President Bush, and he's such a tough guy, a tough politician, as I was told later, he exerted pressure on us and we had to agree. It's ridiculous. It's like kindergarten. Where are the guarantees? What kindergarten is this? What kind of people are these? Who are they? You see, they were pressed, they agreed. And then they say, Ukraine won't be in the NATO, you know? I say, I don't know. I know you agreed in 2008. Why won't you agree in the future? Well, they pressed us then. I say, why?
Yeah, that's probably a good place to leave off for tonight. We made it to the 21st century. So I think that's about as good as we can expect for one night of this, given
prefer the 9th century. I mean, like, they had better hats.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, you've got good hats, or you've got like the Geneva Convention and indoor plumbing. I mean, like, take your pick.
Yeah, at least the hats keep you warm. The Geneva Convention. Try exercising that in Gaza.
Yeah. You can't keep a family of four warm with a Geneva Convention.
What about smart guy glasses? Did they have what would they wear in the 9th century to look intelligent and to see better? Did they have bifocals back then?
No. I think you're. Choice was limited to maybe like one of those plague doctor masks or just leprosy sores, right?
Yeah, definitely want to wear the plague doctor mask to look smart. Like that's, covers up the leprosy sores if you have any. Like you're a doctor, right? You know, you must know something. I guess that would have been the equivalent. So there are a couple of interesting things in that last section. One of them that's just like a small funny thing is Putin's referring to Bill Clinton as Bill and assuring us that he wouldn't lie about Bill, right? It's like, no, ask him, right? I wouldn't lie about this, right? Which is like actually kind of funny, right? Because there's implication there. That there are certain things that you know that he might lie about, but
yeah, I wish we could hear Michael Brooks's impersonation of Bill Clinton talking about like meeting with Putin and whatever he'd come up with about, you know, it was like, and I told him, my wife, whatever direction Michael would then go into.
Yeah, for sure. But it's also, okay. So, you know, that's interesting. It's also interesting to see the sort of moments that Tucker interjects, right? Because for the most part, the ninth through late 20th century, that section of the conversation, Tucker's interventions were largely limited to occasional stabs at bringing things to the 2020s. He'd ask how this was relevant. He would ask if other countries were allowed to start wars based on things that happened in the ninth century. And Putin would mostly just kind of steamroll past him. But he might
want to ask, like, why do the Ukrainians seem to think that they are a different thing? What's that about?
How did they get that impression? Is it, you know, because
why does the only vote that count is the one in Moscow?
Yeah, I mean that since Putin's story about this seems to largely be that Ukrainian nationalism was made up by the Bolsheviks and after 1917, you might wonder how it is that the Ukrainians themselves became so thoroughly convinced of all of this stuff, even as they discarded all the rest. But, you know, he wasn't going to do any of that. Tucker wasn't really interested in directly challenging the narrative. He was only interested in try to push back against how the narrative could possibly be relevant to the argument that Putin was presumably building up to. But then as we got into the post-Soviet era, we started to see Tucker's particular fixations coming out basically two times. One of them was the thing about the deep state toward the very end. So the presidents are making decisions, but then the agency heads are contradicting them. So it's wouldn't you say, tee him up with the talking point that decisions aren't being made by the people we elect? And Putin, you know, is like game for going along with that. Although it's also like kind of a funny talking point to tee up for Vladimir Putin, who's presumably not that invested in the sanctity of elections. But then the other one where Putin wasn't game was that Tucker wanted to grind one of his very favorite axes, which is the one about China, right? That he said, so you're saying that like the U.S. is afraid of strong Russia, but they don't seem to be afraid of a strong China. Because this is Tucker's whole thing, right? That he thinks that, you know, like Tucker objects to anti-Russia hawkery pretty much to the extent that he thinks that it's a diversion from anti-China hawkery. And in fact, there are statements where Tucker's gone as far as to say, the United States should be like an alliance with Russia against China. And so that's what that question was about. It's like, oh, why are they afraid of a strong Russia when they don't seem to be afraid of a strong China? And Putin was like, what are you talking about? Yes, they are.
Yeah, that was I'm not a deep state expert, but that claim really didn't seem true. I was just like, they're not. I mean, I guess if he's only counting the Democratic Party when he says the United States, not that no one in the Democratic Party, but obviously we've talked about on this show Republican politicians fear mongering about China. That obviously has to count. That obviously has to count for something.
Cuba.
I think that, quite frankly, it comes down to complexion. The idea of an Asiatic great power, right? A yellow peril is something that really does get a lot of people's blood up on the American right, while Putin seems like a based white guy. And I like how little time Putin has to for entertaining this entire line of reasoning.
Yeah, because he's just like, yeah, what are you talking about? Like, you know, you don't think the United States is trying to counter China? You're crazy, right? He didn't even say you're crazy, because that would have suggested that he was more invested in, like, entertaining the question than he was. He was just like, what? That's not true. Anyway, about 1654. you mentioned the Republicans, and of course it's true that the Republicans are, like, more rhetorically intense about it, but look, I mean, the Biden administration has actually continued a lot of what Trump did, you know, in terms of relations with China, and increasing tensions there. I mean, Joe Biden actually said a couple of times that if that were the analog to the Ukraine war to play out in Taiwan, that the United States would actually directly militarily intervene on the side of Taiwan, which was like the first time he said that in, summer 2022. That was a big deal because, you know, decades and decades of strategic ambiguity that the U.S. never quite said what they would do in that situation. I mean, to the point, I mean, just guess this is kind of a deep statey thing too, that like the White House communication was like trying to awkwardly walk back the fact that he said it. It's like, what the president meant when he said yes in the answer to that yes or no question was, you know, maybe. So, you know, I mean, in Tucker's understanding of the world, you know, the U.S., you know, isn't hostile enough to China. But, you know, it's the sort of basic premise that the U.S. is less interested in countering Chinese power than the Russian power, you know, is like pretty hard to sustain outside of that, you know, that, you know, like, certainly if you look at like the U.S. relationship with Taiwan and, you know, and all that, it's a very weird thing, but it's like the God thing that we didn't get to tonight. It's like one of these things that, like Tucker is kind of saying for the Tucker fans at home, and Putin doesn't really know or care what the Tucker fans at home think. And so he's just like, what? No.
I think Putin was saying some stuff for the Putin fans at home that Tucker didn't give a fuck about, or to trigger people that Tucker also didn't actually know what he was even doing. You're clearly an expert.
Yeah. If anybody's cheering for the talking points about 1654, it's clearly not Tucker's audience. You know, it might be the Putin super fans at home. But yes, very, very, very few Americans were really following most of that, or, you know, had any reaction to it other than just kind of, you know, befuddlement about the point, or sort of much later on trying to read the tea leaves, or like, okay, so could this be the analogy he's trying to make when he brings up this part? Because it's just, you know, it's on the... On the face of it, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. And, you know, if you want to come at this from the perspective of, well, you know, Kuba said earlier, it gave Putin a chance to look professorial and, you know, intellectually dominate Tucker. You know, fair enough. I also agree with Tom from Yakubi in the chat, said that intellectually dominating Tucker Carlson should be a low bar for a major world leader. But
doesn't mean it's not fun.
Fair enough. But like, as a general rule, I mean, if you're, you know, if you're justifying, you know, your like present day foreign policy by reference to things that happened centuries ago, that's usually not a good sign.
Yeah.
Well, Ben, I think the people are demanding a part two because it was the contributions from myself and Deep State Cuba were so enriching. Mostly Deep State Cuba, but I think the people are demanding a part two on this.
Yeah. Well, look, now that everybody has glasses, it's all on the same level. We should definitely, we won't do the on-air production meeting, but we should definitely figure out a part two to finish this up. But meanwhile, thank you so much, Kuba. Always really,
pleasure
really
of mine.
Appreciate the perspective. And meanwhile, having, you know, everybody's as loath as I am to quote Roger Waters, given the larger subject of discussion, now that everybody's had their meat, they can have their pudding. So in the post game for patrons, we're going to be joined by friend of show Coda Neutron, and we are going to leave aside 1654 for tonight and talk about movies. In fact, specifically, what's that?
The 1619 project. That's the topic.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah, we're going back further than 1654. Also, not a good fucking sign if your thoughts about domestic policy have to be justified in terms of anything that happened in the 1600s. That's also not good. Turns out that, since 1619 and even I would argue since 1654, a bunch of stuff has changed and you should probably be able to, Jake, you look way too confused for a man with your glasses about the statement that I just made. So you should be able to justify your stuff with more recent reference.
I'm getting resting Tucker face after watching him for so fucking long.
Yeah, fair enough. No, we are going to, for tonight's pudding, we are going to watch Ben Shapiro rank movie franchises. And I have already seen part of this, and folks, it's not good. So that's going to be in the post game for patrons. If you are one of those, you should already have the link. If you are not, there's really no time like the present. Patreon.com/Ben Burgess. After tonight, I think our FSB money is drying right up. So, like after all the ill that's been spoken of Putin tonight. So it makes us really rely on the patrons.
Thank God for the North Korean won.
Yeah, that and the Patreon is all we've got left to keep this afloat. So do consider becoming a patron. And if you are one already, we will see you in just a moment. Left is best.